Tonight I'll talk about the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha, or a takeoff on them. I'm really not sure where this is going to go. I was thinking a while ago, you know, when these retreats are, when they're promoted or advertised, they don't say, in this retreat you'll be experiencing some really intense physical and emotional pain, mental frustration and self-doubt and self-hatred, and tons of aversion, and you'll think maybe you're never going to get out of this alive. And if you still want to come, the Yuji talks about, you know, loving kindness and insight, and come and get calm and tranquil, and presents that side, but we know what we really have to go through. The first thing that Upandita said to me when I came for a long period of practice in Burma as a monk, he said, "Your only task is to be in the present moment. I'll take care of everything else." So that's exactly how it was. The monastic compound was well kept, and the generosity of the community is plenty of food, two all-you-can-eat meals early in the morning and before noon, and bedding and blankets in the winter, robes, medicines, everything was always available. And at no cost. There was no mention ever of any kind of financial exchange. And then the teachings were offered freely. So it was really true. And I felt that my only task or my only job was learning how to be in the present moment. It's a very simple instruction. But as we know, it's really challenging to authentically, genuinely live in the present moment, be in the present moment, to even understand what that is. So mindfulness, for example, the mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, sati, has nothing to do with the past, nothing to do with a moment ago, and nothing to do with the next moment. This kind of mindful awareness doesn't anticipate anything that's coming or review anything that's gone. It lives entirely in the present moment. Anything to do with the past or future are thoughts, reflective thoughts or anticipation thoughts or reviewing, commenting, analyzing kinds of thoughts. So it takes a lot of support and a lot of other healthy, skillful states to support that mindful presence in order to open up to the truths of dukkha, first truth of dukkha, and the second truth of the cause of dukkha in craving, and the third truth of the end of dukkha in the peace of genuine and total happiness with the absence of craving, and the fourth truth, the path of mindfulness, this path of being in the present moment, what it means, the other skillful states that it attracts, such as the Brahma-viharas that we've just practiced, unconditional love, caring, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Another quality that it attracts is faith. It's the second very short essence teaching I remember getting from Upandita. You know, even though he gave talks every afternoon, but one-on-one sessions, I just remember them like they're yesterday. And that second teaching, he said, was that the awakening and sustaining of faith is the entire spiritual practice. The awakening and sustaining or nurturing of faith is all of our practice. It had a huge impact on me, and I didn't have a clue what it meant. I didn't know what it meant by faith, and I didn't know what it meant by the sustainable nature of this faith. It took a while, even after hearing the definitions and the Sayadaw's explanations of it and the ancient early teachings on it, you know, to finally have it become embodied. I had seen gestures of it when I was six and living in Japan for a year, visiting the Kamakura Buddha with my parents and sister. It's a huge 12th century Buddha. The likeness of it is right in the front of that gateway where my cabin is, you know, where we had interviews last week. There's a sitting Buddha there and a blue ball and so forth. But that particular statue is the Kamakura Buddha. And the impact I received at that age and never forgot was seeing people express emotions I didn't understand. Emotions and demonstrations of what I later came to understand as respect, their hands together and bowing. Flowers like marigolds placed at the feet and hands in front of the Buddha statue. And the silence and soft whispering words when they needed to speak. I got feelings of kinds of faith before I even heard of Vipassana, before I came on this path when I was searching. A first teacher of mine was this Hawaiian woman, Nana Viri, who died in the mid-90s. And she learned from her grandmother and the combination of Hawaiian spirituality and Buddhism. She had gone to India and learned ancient teachings from Buddhist India. She embodied aloha, the word aloha, which is such a tourist cliche. Now no one really knows or remembers what it means, except those who still practice and the renaissance and regeneration of Hawaiian and Polynesian elemental spirituality. She would say that the word aloha, that alo, means the center of the universe, or the bosom of the center of the universe, is how she would explain it, alo. And ha is the breath of life. So when we say aloha to someone coming or leaving, it's this total presence. It's being one center of the universe or one bosom of the center of the universe to another that we see, who also is the center of the universe and who also breathes the breath of life. Ha, aloha, aloha. And her embodiment, you know, like coming to her classes were just all about aloha and hugs, hugging, you know, and laughing. And she would speak and talk about her grandmother, her teacher. And her grandmother, people from Hawaii have amakua. Amakua is a like a guide, usually in the form of a being, a creature, like a gecko, or a whale, or a dolphin, or various land birds. We have only one indigenous mammal. It's the Hawaiian bat. Everything that got to Hawaii had either to fly or float to get there. So seeds and birds of various kinds. And of many amakua, shark is one of them. And Nana Viri's grandmother had a pet shark that she would play with, feed, and ride on the Big Island. It's true. Michelle will have to tell her story probably tomorrow night of her encounter with a shark. But I grew up with them around, and you know, we knew when to be careful and when it was okay. And clearly, her Nana Viri's grandmother had a friendly relationship with this particular tiger shark, which can be dangerous. And it reminded me, thinking of Nana Viri, Hannah Viri was her name, we called her Nana, like it means grandmother. It reminded me of a second teacher I had, was a woman that I met when she was 90 years old. It's also pre-Vipassana, and she was my teacher for 7 years until she passed away from a place called Hemet, California, way east of LA. And her son had like a health, today they call him spa. He was an MD, but they did all these alternative kinds of healing as well. And his mom was sort of hidden up in the hills. And I don't know how I got there, but I got there and had some one-on-ones with her. She was amazing, you know. It's like her skin was translucent. And this is more than 45 years ago. I remember her penetrating and clear sky blue eyes. And she spoke almost as a whisper, almost like a whisper. And it was like she was a mystic. I would call her a mystic. And she said that the universe liked to show itself to her. And it would do so by, she says, the stars come down just outside my window and show me how close the universe is, how everything is inside of us, nothing outside of us. And so I got these little teachings that came again to me, you know, later as I picked up other traditions and this primary lineage of the Mahasi Sayadaw Upandita style of Vipassana from Burma. The vestiges of all those early teachers came alive there. So I was kind of ready to feel what faith felt like, kind of seeing it, seeing demonstrations of it as a kid in the people in their relationship with the Kamakura Buddha and Nana Viri, the embodiment of aloha, and speaking of love as being the crucial element in human spirituality. And Amy Loomis was, she was just beyond the stars, you know. I'm really lucky to have met someone like that. I felt like if I touched her, my hand would go through her. There's something really special, something radiant. She'd say, she would hear teachings in the way that one tunes a radio to a certain frequency, and she'd get teachings from beings somewhere. The awakening and sustaining of faith, if we have some degree of it in the early stages, the tender faith called bright faith is what does get us to a retreat, thinking, well, it might really be something good, maybe not so painful, you know. We didn't have some degree of faith, confidence, we wouldn't come here. You know, or if someone told us what really happens at a retreat, gave us their view of the anguish that one can go through in this purification process. But it evolves, it develops. This early, tender, bright faith is like, it is like lights happening inside in the heart, in the mind, clarity of seeing things. Or like, I remember seeing the really mindful nun walking back and forth, always in the same place. When I'd go at the Mahasi Center in Rangoon, walk to an interview with Upandita, this mindful walking back and forth, it would cause me to stop and observe, and we get like these chills and rushes up and down my spine because it was just so inspiring. It was clear that she was being really mindful. It was like the impact of her awareness reverberating out, like when you throw a stone in water, and it's just these waves of peace coming out. Bright faith and kind of amps up our interest, curiosity, and might bring us to listen to the Dhamma or read a book or hear a talk, and finally to come to a retreat where then we have the experience that makes this bright faith true faith or of confirmed faith, you know, authenticated by our own experience. So what we're told, some of the things we're told, that if we observe our experience, there's this stream of physical phenomena, you know, continuously arising and passing, or various elemental sensations, perhaps at first, and sometimes we see more the unified nature, that all these elements, they're following, they're all somehow related and following some natural law of physics and physicality. Everything seems to be working. We're not making any decisions about a heartbeat or an in-breath or out-breath or, you know, the functioning of our organs. Something just seems to be happening on its own. So we see there's this stream of physicality, And then also, we're taught that there's a stream of mentality, thoughts, feelings, mental states, emotions, and most subtly, the knowing mind or consciousness itself. And that there's no third process. And if you can find a third process, you know, Upandita would say, show me or tell me. So that's what happened, you know, when we sit and we see, experience physical phenomena, sensations are through the eye sensitivity, light is physical phenomena, sound vibrations is physical phenomena, flavors and scent, all physical phenomena. And then that we also indeed have thoughts streaming along, our discursive mind is usually what we notice first. And then these emotive experiences, energetic experience that sometimes involve both the physicality and mentality. Strong emotion, you know, has an imprint in the body, impact in the body. And also thoughts and in mental images, often other emotions behind that primary emotion. And then there's the awareness of them, which is also part of our mental stream. And then looking to see if there's, if this is happening because I want it to happen, or if I can stop it, if I wanted to stop it when it hurt. And, you know, asking those questions, and those questions are in the text, or they're asked by when we hear the Dhamma talks in those early years. Can you find anyone to whom this is happening, or out of, from whom these things are happening? So that experiential level of practice is what increases this faith, makes it confirmed, and then is what keeps us going, you know, all the way through. It keeps becoming fulfilled in each new insight that we understand as the practice progresses, and we see and learn more the intricacies of the mind, what it feels like to be attached or not attached. You know, we're directed to see all these various experiences. Mindfulness, what it does experience is what's real, what's true, what is felt experience. So bodily sensations is real. We feel textures. We feel pressure and vibrations and fluidity and cohesion, knots and streaming, heat and cool. So that's real. And feelings, another domain of exploration of our experience. Feelings are mental, even though many of them certainly apply to the body. Feelings here, not emotions. That comes under the other categories, the remaining two categories. The second category of feeling is simply the affect of each moment's experience. So feeling, for example, it's not a choice. We don't choose to have a pleasant feeling. It's just nature. And we don't have a choice to get rid of unpleasant feeling tones when they arise, or to abide in the neutral equanimous feeling tone. They just happen. So no intention. They just arise with perception and with other mental faculties that are necessary to have a moment of experience. Obviously, the knowing mind. And obviously, there has to be some concentration, not spacing off, and some attention. But the feeling tone is one of the important ones and one of the gateways or portals to momentary and deeper, ultimately permanent liberation. Because feelings free us up from the attachments that are weighty, that are choice-driven. There is a choice behind craving and clinging and holding on. And there is a choice or intention behind aversion, ill will, rejection, pushing away. And there is a choice to be spaced out, you know, delusional, ignorant of what's happening. We see that because there's this tremendous space of the present moment that mindfulness creates. And we start to see there actually is a little gap or a little nano moment between a pleasant feeling tone and the habit of holding on to it. That is the decision, intention to cling to it. There's a space. That's why we have retreats, to discover these spaces. There's a space between everything. Every sensation, every thought, every motivation, every intention. It's just, there's a moment. And the more we deepen this mindfulness and reside in the present, understand mindfulness, that it's not thought, it's pre-verbal. So it's not about the past or the future. Those are reflective or anticipatory mental qualities. Resting in the present moment, we see this pain, this pressure, this burning in the knee. Yeah, it's unpleasant. It's a stream of unpleasant sensations. And it just is. It's the truth. It's the body. It's the body language. Letting awareness know that this is the body. This is truth. Aversion, ill will, is extra. It's a reactive, like a decision to not feel that feeling of unpleasantness. So we can feel and be aware of the aversion, as we've been talking about, how to work with the aversions and ill wills and rejections and denial, or the attachment, clinging, and craving. You can see and know what they are. They're called the hindrances. And they're hindrances because they have the potential to hinder calm and insight. So we're not making them wrong or bad. We're just seeing and understanding them, for it is the understanding of them that allows us to let go. Letting go isn't a decision. When we see clearly what's true, it's just that the habit of clinging to pleasant or pushing away unpleasant drops away, because we see that it's painful to hold on. And we see, we understand then the relationship between clinging and dukkha. Dukkha as the first noble truth of dissatisfaction and unreliability, fragility, because of change, because of impermanence. There's nothing there to hold on to. So I discovered Vipassana in Boulder, Colorado, in 1974, where I went thinking I was going to hang out with my friend Ram Dass, who stayed in my home when he came to Hawaii, and he was going to be there as one of the stars of the opening of Naropa Institute. And the other and major star, founder of Naropa, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And it was just this spiritual supermarket, you know. Thousands of young, mostly hippies, everyone kind of doing everything, you know. Anything you can think of, sensitivity, awareness, and and chanting, and singing, and drama, and poetry, you know, Allen Ginsberg, and Diane De Prima, and, you know, these amazing people were there. And all the traditions, all the Buddhist traditions and Indian traditions, Tibetan. So it was such a scene that it was too loud for me. So I went to these quiet other classes, and that's where I met Joseph Goldstein, teaching just this simple Mahasi method of being mindful. But every night, it would be either Ram Dass or Trungpa Rinpoche talking, and they'd be like a ping pong or tennis match, you know. They'd be throwing barbs at each other, and they're because of different trainings, different traditions, and that's what they did, right? But one night I went there and I heard Trungpa Rinpoche say, "The bad news is you're falling through the air. Nothing to hang on to. No parachute. The good news is there is no ground." I kind of thought, well, this is, well, you know, that's cool poetry, and where'd that come from? And, you know, I didn't get the depth of that yet. But I kept going to the classes, various classes, for 6 weeks. And at the end of the summer, it was the first Vipassana retreat in this Burmese tradition in America. It was 30 days long. And I did it. I was a really happy young kid, you know. It set me on a path I never turned back from. And it actually synthesized and crystallized, and it brought everything, all the other traditions I had been experimenting together. It didn't reject anything. So what I had done with Nana Viri or Amy Loomis and other teachers, Chinese martial arts and Tai Chi, actually my first Buddhist teacher, it validated all of that, you know, and it brought a very clear and sensible path of practice, you know, how to do this. That's what we're doing. How to sit, call up attention, be aware of postures, be aware of movements in the body, and get, if you can, refine attention down to the elemental nature of the body, just the body vibration or hum, you know, cellular level, elemental level, buzzing of the bodily nature, and then explore feeling tone as it applies to body or mind states or six sense doors. Every moment of experience, it's there, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. If we miss the pleasant, we're attached. And what we're attached to is the pleasant, not the object we think we want. Not the person that we think will make us happy, or the school that we wanted to get into, and or the, you know, Tesla, or whatever we would like to drive, you know. One floating around in space. We kind of miss all that, and so we get pulled into the objects of things when what we're attached to, but don't quite see, because it's so fleeting and so quick, and that therefore teaches us about the nature of impermanence. The velocity with which things are arising and passing away is the feeling tone. And likewise, when it's unpleasant, we mistake the object and think it's the object of the unpleasant. We're feeling aversion or ill will because we miss the unpleasant sensation and go after the object, get rid of it, you know, take it away, change postures, change everything, you know, because experience is unpleasant. Until we recognize that we've missed something. We haven't seen something that's true, authentic, and real about ourselves and about life. These feeling tones. And the subtlest of them is a neutral one. Subtle because it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. And missing it cultivates, just like attachment cultivates the mind of craving and wanting and seeking, and it's to excess. What we're looking at is not our little desires, small attachments, but the insatiable craving. That is what is the cause of our dukkha, of our distress, of our anxiety, all of our suffering. And the unpleasant is the same. The cause of our suffering is we miss the unpleasant and blame it on the object, whether it's the person, the world, the situation. Where if we can just rest and feel these feeling tones and then come to know that we don't want to cultivate attachment, we don't want to cultivate aversion, we don't want that as our personality default states, and we don't want to put that energy out. We also don't want to cultivate delusion or spacing out, not seeing clearly, ignorance. And that's what happens when we miss that neutral feeling tone. It's connected to delusion, just as attachment's connected to greed and ill will is connected to hatred. Of those three unhealthy psychological states, greed, hatred, delusion, and their manifestations in clinging, our aversion, ill will, our spacing out, not seeing clearly, cloudy vision, and everything that comes from that that we are quite familiar with, doubt. Doubt comes from that delusion. Actually, restlessness comes from that delusion. And restlessness is with us for a long time. It's said in this tradition, it doesn't go until the fourth stage of enlightenment. It doesn't disappear until then, as does ignorance, the last remnants of ignorance. So it's like knowing what we're working with. It's not meant that we feel driven to rid ourselves of these qualities. We're meant to understand them. You know, how does attachment, what are all the ways attachment affects my practice and aversion and my life and relationships and delusion, numbing out, spacing out, not seeing clearly. Even as we start to get very quiet and we feel a great deal of attachment and retreat, it's a lot of release and retreat, a lot of natural, organic letting go happens, not by our wish or by a decision, it's by our presence, it's the power of that present time awareness. And therefore practice becomes more subtle. That's how it goes from experiencing the grosser aspects of bodily movement and change in sensations, right down to that most refined, subtle hum, vibration of the body. And really has to be a lot of letting go in the mind to see it on that level, not be bothered, not be affected by the pleasant experiences that begin to occur, and not be affected by the unpleasant experiences that continue to occur. You know, once we have an opening, an insight, great. It feels like just this flush of energy and joy and gladness and delight and opening. Body feels free. We may think, ah, finally. But that opening, it just makes space for another round of dukkha. It will come. But we will be more able to be with it will be more skilled at just seeing and understanding again, okay, it's just unpleasant. It's just a flow of unpleasant experience, physically, emotionally, mentally, and no need to have that tight energy of needing to get rid of it or going after something else, that, like chasing a pleasure. At the same time, the quieter we get, you know, when mindfulness gets down to like just a whisper of awareness, so does craving. And we start to crave a lot of the pleasant experiences that are native to practice, organic, that the kinds of pleasure that aren't dependent on the senses. Dhamma pleasures, Upandita would call them. The pleasures, delights, and joy that come from becoming quiet, from being protected from the constant distractions or intrusions of wanting or sleepiness or aversion or doubt. We start to enjoy an inner kind of joy that is something like we've never experienced before. If we're not watchful, there is subtle craving to hold on to it, and we don't see it. The first time I became aware of how intensely we can become attached without seeing it, without being aware, I was at a long retreat with Upandita, and he saw that I was this subtle craving in me. It's called a corruption of insight. You know, the result of having had some good practice, and the result is the joy and delight that comes from such insights. Insight into dukkha itself isn't misery, isn't painful. The understanding of dukkha, the understanding that there's dukkha because of change, because there's nothing really to hold on to, brings delight to the mind, not more dukkha, and makes the mind happy. And the result of joy in the mind is joy in the body. It's easy to forget to be on guard to wanting that joy to stay or not wanting it to disappear. So Upandita gave me this exercise of just watching feeling tones. It didn't mean that the other things were out of my awareness. I took the resolve to do that, and of course I felt elemental sensations and heard sounds and their thoughts and their intrusions and distractions and all that. But taking that resolve, primarily my attention was aimed at moment to moment, connecting, touching the feeling tone every moment, wherever it was arising, in the body, in the senses, thought process, emotions, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And so I did that for a week, and a few days into it, I discovered the attachment because it was suddenly absent. I came to know that attachment had been there because of its absence. And something just shifted in me. You know, because the attachment requires a certain holding on, a certain tension arc in the mind, a certain tightness if we look closely in the body. And when it's gone, there's just a greater degree of openness and relaxation. So I didn't notice it suddenly fell away. I didn't see it in the first place. I just sort of noticed a shift, and the pleasantness of my experience was no longer kind of manifesting as like a thrill. you know, a high. And then I went for an interview, and Upandita said, "Now, would you like to move on in your practice? Would you like to move along? Because if we can get stuck there, and yogis get stuck there sometimes for a very long time. You know, in fact, most meditations in the world, in fact, a lot of the Vipassana meditation, yogis tend to, even the oldest students, lean toward feel-good experience. Lean toward the peaceful states of mind, tranquil states of mind. And that's the mind that's leaning into tranquility meditation or concentration meditation. Samatha, it's called. That's what we just did for a week. So having done that for a week, those of you, most of you who have done that, you now have the capacity, now that we're doing Vipassana, or in some cases side by side, some Brahmavihara concentration practice and some Vipassana moment-to-moment awareness practice, it's easy to see that tendency. I like that feeling good sensation. Of course we like that feeling good sensation. But you need not fear. It's actually better not to go in that direction, because the kinds of happiness that await us in further insight practice is greater than that habit of just going to that place we've been to a lot of times, that's where there's calm and tranquility, some equanimity, and it just, it's relaxed and it feels good. Of course we like that, but there's more and better to come with the insight practice. You just have to be willing to go through more purification and so more discomfort at times, dukkha at times, healthy kinds of fear and sorrow at times. Sometimes we feel this like existential sadness, sorrow. And it's not born of ill will. Upandita's teacher, Mahasi Sayadaw, called them spiritual sorrow, spiritual sadness. Because it comes from our inner work. And as we feel those deeper levels of discomfort, sadness, sorrow, grief, loss, we move deeper into the practice. Yes, they're unpleasant. And we recognize their unpleasant. But knowing they are healthy kinds of difficult emotions, we let go at those efforts or habits of getting rid of them and trying to get back to that samatha happiness, concentration, peace, and are willing to go through those kinds of fear, healthy fear, sorrow, sadness, and see that, yeah, it's vast, it's huge, and everyone experiences it, and we mistake it so often. We don't see it for what it is. We see it for something that we like or dislike. We want to get rid of because we'd rather have this. Well, this talk is almost finished and I've hardly started.
Part two.
Yeah, there'll be a part two. Just a little bit. I mean, a lot of what I'm talking about came from questions and answers this morning and interviews in the last day or so. You know, a beautiful way of holding our practice, I think, is, and it came from a poignant interview I had with someone today, a friend and yogi, is that this arc, this like healthy tension arc between vulnerability and equanimity. You know, on the one hand, this practice is so opening and to really be present in the present moment and requires this sensitivity and this willingness to be so incredibly open and so revealing to ourselves, you know, energetically to our neighbors and to the teachers in the interview, of our emotions, deepest longings and fears and so forth. It is that very vulnerability that carries the practice to deeper and deeper, more profound places of opening and seeing and understanding, and allows for some of the deepest, difficult stuff to come out, you know, our trauma tremors, so to speak, recent and old, you know, riding horses for much of my life. My mom came from ranchers and farmers in California, and I spend every summer from 7 to 17 as a cowboy with my Spanish uncle. Learned to swear from him too. And the horses, you know, they're so attuned to their environment, and suddenly they can freeze, tighten, and be spooked if they smell a mountain lion, cougar, or bear, and even throw you off if you don't know what's happening or don't know, you know, how to stay with the horse or to help calm the horse. And you just talk to the horse, pat her or him, and wait. And in time, before long, there's these shudders, the horse just shudders. It's like shaking off those trauma moments. You keep shaking it off. They know how to shake it off. We, on the other hand, usually store it, stack it, layer. And we find it here in retreat. And as the unlayering happens organically, and it happens best organically, not by, as Michelle said, it's like an archaeological site, but we don't get our platinum shovels out, you know, to dig deep and rough. Get those real fine brushes, the finest artist brushes, and just move some of the dust off the top here and there and start to reveal what's there. The trauma or the emerging gold of our goodness, they're part of the same arc between that sensitivity, that vulnerability, the shuddering that wants to happen, to shake it all, shake off, and the equanimity, on the other hand, that's developed from the first moment we're mindful, the stabilization of all of our systems, the calming of our systems. If we keep these two in alignment, you know, aware of them, we won't err toward leaning to just how good the equanimity and related states feel, contentment, tranquility, calm, or happy states. We let them come, and we let them do what they do, because this practice ultimately is going from one pleasure to the next. Insights are deeply pleasurable, non-dependent Dhamma joys, and we're going from joy to joy. Along the road, we have these trauma shudders. Well, can we hold the vulnerability and the equanimity? Can we hold that tension arc? And now, I'm going to end with this poem called Reading an Anthology. I've only read it like once because I think that people maybe not won't get it, but this is a very intelligent group of yogis. And your stillness and your capacity to listen is deep. I was like scared to read it to Europeans and when we're in Burma or I don't know why. Cause I did read it somewhere.
Because of the translation issue.
Translation issue, yeah. Satirical. It's satirical. Billy Collins is making fun and appreciating at the same time how poets, the old poets, Japanese and Chinese, they tell everything ahead of time in the title of the poem. So here he goes, reading an anthology. It seems these poets have nothing up their ample sleeves. They turn over so many cards so early, telling us before the first line whether it is wet or dry, night or day, the season the man is standing in, even how much he has had to drink. Maybe it is autumn and he is looking at a sparrow. Maybe it is snowing on a lawn with a beautiful name. Quote, viewing peonies at the temple of good fortune on a cloudy afternoon is one of Sung Tang Po's. And dipping water from the river and simmering tea is another one. Or just on a boat, awake at night. And Lu Yu takes the simple rice cake with, in a boat on a summer evening, I heard the cry of a water bird. It was very sad and seemed to be saying, my woman is cruel. Moved, I wrote this poem. There is no iron turnstile to push against here, as with headings like vortex on a string or the horn of neurosis or whatever. No confusingly inscribed welcome mat to puzzle over. Instead, I walk out on a summer morning to the sound of birds and a waterfall. It's a beaded curtain brushing over my shoulders, and 10 days of spring rain have kept me indoors. It's a servant who shows me into the room where a poet with a thin beard is sitting on a mat with a jug of wine, whispering something about clouds and cold wind, about the sickness and the loss of friends. How easy he has made it for me to enter here, to sit down in a corner, cross my legs like his, and listen. Let's listen.